Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. 5.8% unemployment rate. Positive, but a slightly less than expected 214,000 new jobs on the payrolls. Not that it does much good for President Obama in a bad political week, but all this, our job advice from you out there. We're going to have some fun, funniness. Comedian Maria Bamford opens her very rich and painfully funny mind to us. Thank you, Maria. Although she clearly can't help herself, we learn from our own Kristen Meinzer. We'll have fun even about the economy. Did you know there is a Jimmy Fallon effect, being nice as an economic driver? And we'll talk about a rediscovered gem of a story from the man who wrote The Grapes of Wrath. But Charlie Herman is with us, business and economics editor for The Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. Charlie, welcome. 5.8% unemployment. You have a minute to give me the takeaway from this Department of Labor report.
Well, what we're seeing here is a pretty consistent, solid job gains, but we're not at the level that we really need to see to really get the economy to really take off. I mean, this is good. It's sort of like the rocket ship is starting to take off. It's getting some steam, but it hasn't really gone incredibly fast or at the speed that we need to. I think things are really lining up for 2015 to look really good, barring any sort of major catastrophe to come along the way. But, you know, what we really need to see is more people getting hired. We need to see the number of people in the labor force. You know, we've seen that number declining because people feel they can't find work. We need them to come back to start getting jobs. And I think as more people start getting hired, we might start seeing wages go up. That's the biggest thing, the biggest trend we've noticed is despite the unemployment rate at 5.8%, people still aren't really making more money, that their real wages adjusted for inflation are at about the level that they've been since 2000.
So you can see people rowing in the economy, but they really need to gain wages for this thing to take off.
You know, more people in the boat, you're going to go faster and farther. Right now, it's rowing. It's going forward. We're at a 4-man boat. Let's get up to an 8-man boat.
Click. You did it. Charlie Herman, Takeaway co-producer, economics and business editor. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The raw national job numbers may be about business cycles and the tidal waves of supply and demand, but they are also the collective energy of people learning to make their own ways, to reinvent, to ride the changes in the economy, to make jobs their own, to hold on any way they can. Individual intelligences determined to make it, not as billionaires necessarily, but just as stable pieces of this economy we talk about all the time. Here's one. Joining us is Mark Weitz & Korn, president of Weitz & Korn's, a men's clothing store in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. How many years have you been in business, Mark?
This year we're celebrating 150 years.
And you're generation number?
Four.
So what is the secret to your success?
I think you just have to kind of change with the times, whether it be your merchandise mix or your advertising strategies or what products you offer.
And your relationships with your customers, everybody knows you. People know of, you know, your store as well as they know anything else in town?
A lot of people do, yeah. I mean, we're a destination store in our area. And as my father said years ago, pretend you're doing business in the middle of a cornfield. Give people a reason to come to you and then give them a reason to come back. So it's the way we treat people and try to call everybody by first name that we know.
Pretend you're doing business in a cornfield?
In the middle of a cornfield.
That is brilliant. That's brilliant. Now you're going to be wiped out by the internet, right?
No, we're my nephew, my brother's son, my brother's my partner. His son is more computer savvy, and for a couple of years now, we've been working hard to increase our presence on the internet, and that's been a real growth area for us.
And so I can go to Weitz & Korn's and
WeitzAndKornsMenswear.com,
and I can order a bow tie. I can order an instruction book how to actually tie the bow tie.
You can get all kinds of things from Tommy Bahama clothing. That we have our own Tommy Bahama shop, to Hugo Boss suits and sportswear. Yeah, anything you want, we'll ship it to you.
What is it about your spirit or intelligence or determination that insulates you from the horrors that are happening to the JCPenney's and the Sears of the world right now?
Well, you know, I think you have to keep some of your competition mindful, but I think you really have to stay focused on who you are and how you handle people, what products you give them, the service you give them. We have our own full-time tailor shop right on premise. We literally are a one-stop shop. We have everything from hats to shoes and from blue jeans to tuxedos.
Now, are you hiring right now?
Actually, I am looking for somebody part-time getting into the holiday since my nephew is pretty well devoted to the internet. We need to have some more floor coverage, yes.
Mark Weitz and Korn, have a great holiday season and hope to visit you down there in Pottstown.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Mark Weitz and Korn is president of Weitz and Korn's, a men's clothing store that has been in business for 150 years in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And now a less traditional example of determination in a challenging economy, people holding on with their own intelligence, by their own intelligence even. Shane Snow joins us, technology journalist and author of Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Shane, welcome.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here.
So there's lots to talk about in this book, but I want to focus on one particular story, which I think everybody knows who Jimmy Fallon is, but how he made it to his position as host of The Tonight Show, I think says a lot about the value of relationships and networking and really doing what's absolutely necessary to make yourself indispensable in any particular office setting. How did you find out about that story, and tell me, what happened?
Yeah. So how I got that story is through networking myself. I ended up meeting his very first manager when he was just this kid in upstate New York that knew no one and no one knew him.
Studying computer science or something.
Right. And he didn't even finish. And he was just kind of this bumpkin, right, from Socrates, New York, or someplace like that. The thing that I was really interested in about his story is they always say the classic advice in networking is, or in business, is it's not what you know, it's who you know. Well, Jimmy knew no one. And he managed to get on Saturday Night Live, this very coveted position, in just 2 years. Clearly, he's talented. He deserves the success he got.
Sure, sure, sure.
But I was interested in the question, well, what did he do that got him there? And was it just sheer luck?
I don't think it was luck at all. What did he do?
First thing that, if you meet anyone who knows Jimmy Fallon, the first thing they'll say is he's the nicest guy in the world. And people aren't like that in Hollywood. But the thing that he did, when he first got the call from this this young manager, He gave a tape of him doing stand-up comedy up there in New York and gave it to his friend who then moved to L.A. And he said, if you find someone in L.A., give them my tape. And this tape ended up in the hands of this young manager. And she called him up and she said, hi, this is Randy Siegel from, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I know who you are. And it kind of threw her back on her feet. Like, how would you know who I am? And it's because he was obsessed with all of the stars of Saturday Night Live that he memorized kind of their management agencies and the rosters of who worked in that business. While his friends were memorizing sports stats, he was memorizing how the comedy business worked. So there's this obsession that was kind of surprising to people, but also it was just this good-hearted passion that came through versus a lot of other people that that try and hustle and try and give you their business card and give you their tape. He truly, at his core, wanted to know everything about this business. And I think that was the very first thing. But then once he was on the show, It's not like the game is over once you're, 22-year-old cast member of Saturday Night Live. Right. And we know today he became, the youngest host of The Tonight Show in decades. There's this great interview that just came out in Men's Journal that talks about how after every show, he went up to the showrunner, to Lorne Michaels, who's this kind of...
God.
Right, exactly. Yeah, scary God. Is the wrong word, but intimidating guy. And he would go up and he would thank him every night after every show. He'd always go up and show his gratitude. And not in kind of a weaselly, I want something from you kind of way. He just was genuinely kind.
And those meetings were actually like, how did we do on the show? What did you think, Jimmy? That kind of thing. It evolved into, instead of just sort of playing around, this kind of strategy session.
Right. And which gets to one of the points that I make in the book is that in networking and sort of in business especially, but it's applied to anything we want to do in careers, the better strategy for networking is not to ask, but to give. To give first and to provide value, to show even people that have, a god of comedy like Lorne Michaels needs something and, feedback and ideas and strategy and or just pure gratitude. Giving first without an ask is the better strategy for building up a network of fans, essentially. He built fans in very high places by giving rather than asking, rather than being sort of smarmy and schmoozy like you see in Hollywood.
All right. So a lot of people who are listening to this say, oh, Jimmy Fallon, that's going to help me, get a job, anywhere at Google, whatever. What is the lesson here? What is the takeaway from Fallon's experience that so impressed you as a kind of universal language of making it in the 21st century economy?
Yeah. So I was exploring the question of, again, it's not what you know, it's who you know, and the role of mentorship throughout the ages. So from Socrates to, you know, Star Wars to Steve Jobs, you always see in these great rapid success stories the presence of a mentor, you know, Mr. Miyagi helping the Karate Kid learn karate faster than if he learned on his own. So I was interested in exploring how does mentorship help. So the research shows that great mentorship relationships that are organic, that are not forced, that are not formal, but that are sort of mentors guiding your journey does help in terms of future salaries and better careers and not going to jail and things like that. But there are a lot of people who are just born in spots where they don't have a natural network. You know, there's some kid across the world who didn't have access to Socrates, but, you know, Plato did. And so that's not fair. So I was exploring how do people take advantage of this idea of other people from the top helping you up. And this is what Jimmy did with Adam Sandler in particular, that he obsessed with the biography and all of the history and all of the shows that Adam Sandler did to try and imitate him and to figure out kind of what would Adam do. And that became sort of the guiding principle of his life. And you see this in incredible people throughout history, from Ben Franklin to one of the other people I wrote about, Elon Musk, who has this space company and runs Tesla. People like these, what they do is they, rather than just read sort of your general, you know, magazines or books, they read obsessively the biographies of great people in their fields or that came before them. So that's kind of the moral of the story from Jimmy Fallon is, and if you read the book that I get into more nuance, is that he knew that there were people out there that had been the very best, that had succeeded before him, who could teach him. And even if he couldn't meet them, that he could learn from them and he could obsess over their lives.
Shane, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Shane Snow is technology journalist and author of Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success.
Hi, this is Marnie from Ferndale, Michigan. I find to keep my job, I try to be as innovative and flexible as much as possible. I've assumed additional duties that aren't technically in my job description, but that has made me far more valuable to my employer. They know I can be relied on to get the job done.
Smart Marnie from Ferndale. Here's advice from San Jose, California. Connections, connections. Be bold. Put any feelings of embarrassment aside. Make yourself available to any opportunities that come up at work. Learn new things. Be visibly busy, but friendly. You want people to remember you in a positive way. Portland, Oregon. Get creative with negotiating. My job in a position I created myself. The organization had no open positions, but I told them my ideas and offered to volunteer for a month. If they didn't feel I was useful after that period, they didn't have to hire me. I've been with them for 3 years now.
This is Leslie Palmer from San Antonio, Texas. Don't hang on if it's making you miserable. Sometimes you have to take a leap of faith. The best tip I've found is networking. Talk to everyone you know about your job, even if they are not in your field of work. You never know who is in someone's sphere of influence.
My name is Joshua Newman. I'm calling from Lucas, Texas. The best tip I could give anyone in pretty much any industry is learn public speaking. I think that's really the single most important thing, because it really doesn't matter what job you have, whether you're flipping burgers, whether you're coding for a large corporation, selling Mary Kay products. If you know how to communicate eloquently, confidently, and clearly, you're more likely to be hired, you're more likely to be promoted, and you're more likely to keep your job when hard times come. I mean, in the end, it really doesn't matter what you're doing. Knowing how to communicate well is going to help you.
That's one small burger for man, one giant burger for mankind. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. On September 26th, 43 college students disappeared in southern Mexico after a confrontation with police in the city of Iguala. A group of young men and women in training to become teachers became hostages, or worse. Prosecutors believe the mayor and police of Iguala apprehended the students and delivered them to a drug gang. Aside from the pure horror of this story, it has revealed how the entire town is somehow in the employ of the cartels. This week, the city's mayor, Jose Luis Abarca, and his wife were arrested. No sign of the missing students, and in an echo of the Boko Haram kidnappings in Nigeria, tens of thousands of Mexicans have been protesting in the capital demanding that the government find them. Joan Grillo is a senior correspondent for Global Post and the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. He says this incident shows once again the erosion of the rule of law throughout Mexico and Central America.
When you have this whole group attacked and then 43 of them disappearing, being carted off in police cars and then reportedly loaded into a cattle truck, one of the teachers' faces being sliced off and his body being dumped on the street, this created this enormous reaction. I think the perpetrators didn't realize the reaction it would create and how Mexican society would say enough.
Has it exposed the level at which political authorities are actually complicit with the drug cartels?
It has. And we see in this case a very sad and very frightening level of complicity. We have in this town called Iguala, where this happened, a town of 140,000 in Guerrero State, the mayor of the town and his wife alleged to be full-on drug cartel operatives. Now, this is kind of a difference in some ways historically than what happened. You used to have drug cartels bribing mayors, bribing all kinds of officials. But now you're kind of, it's kind of like cutting out the middleman and actually putting the drug cartel operatives in power. And also they're saying that the police officers, again, were not only police officers who were bribed to turn a blind eye, but were police officers who were really cartel assassins in police uniform. Imagine a community where the political power is held by direct cartel operatives, people who are completely involved, immersed in illegal crimes, in drug trafficking culture. So they react to public disturbance, in this case, where you have some rowdy students. They steal buses to go on demonstrations and normally give them back. But they react to it with mass murder, with shooting at them, with kidnapping them. And they, in their insane world, believe they can get away with this.
And the students were not confronting police for any particular political reason. It was a sort of, you know, teenage high school crime and hooliganism or whatever you would call it, yes?
No, it's a bit more complicated than that. Basically, this is student teachers from quite a radical school. It was basically a school set up in the 1920s following the Mexican Revolution to bring literacy to the countryside. And it's created a very radical tradition over the years. More recently, they've been protesting education reforms by President Enrique Peña Nieto, which they find they see as a threat to their jobs. Now, they actually went to Iguala to hijack some buses, ironically, to go on a demonstration in Mexico City to commemorate a massacre of students back in 1968. So they wanted to commemorate students who were killed under the one-party system of 1968, and they found themselves being victims of a new massacre, a new attack in 2014.
A new one-party state.
a new one-party state. Now a bit more complicated than a one-party state. Now we have the same party back in power. But, I mean, this incident really brings up a challenge of Mexico's whole democratic project over the last 14 years. You have democracy, but you have this insane level of violence and you have this level of corruption. These massive problems still exist. And this is a challenge in Mexico, and it's a challenge across the whole of the Americas. Jamaica, Brazil, Colombia, El Salvador, where migrants are leaving and turning up the United States asking for refugee status, and really gets to a fundamental issue that the United States needs to look at in its foreign policy. You can promote democracy, you can promote free markets, but you also need to promote a functioning rule of law for those to exist. You know, imagine this happening somewhere in the United States, some provincial town somewhere, 43 students being kidnapped. Now, after 5 or 6 weeks almost now, they haven't found them. They haven't found either bodies or the students alive. You know, that's a real challenge. It really shows a kind of powerlessness of the government to try and resolve this case. And that makes Peña Nieto look very bad. And kind of, you know, makes all of his efforts, you know, to say Mexico's now doing better, it's open for business, we're rescuing this country, it challenges his whole agenda.
Joan Grillo is a senior correspondent for Global Post and author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Twenty-five years ago this Sunday, something that only a few hoped could ever disappear, those hopes buried in dreams, came alive. And a wall as permanent as the glacial chill of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall, simply melted away. Brick by brick, people grasped the wall with their dreams and dared to pull it down. There was a fellow named Günter Schabowski, an East German official whose confused remarks at a news conference gave birth to the shocking rumor that the wall
was about to open. And then it was done. On Christmas Day in Berlin, 1989, a 71-year-old and sick Leonard Bernstein performed Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. He got it wrong. Ode to Freiheit deliberately replaced Schiller's lyric, Ode to Joy. The freedom only brought that much more joy. Freiheit! The dubious cliché Bernstein said about music as the universal language almost comes true with Beethoven. Bernstein, who had watched the wall go up, could believe that the history of civilization was now speaking through this music. No composer who has ever lived, he said, speaks so directly to so many people, the young, the old, educated and ignorant, amateur, professional, sophisticated, naive, and to all these people, of all classes, nationalities, and racial backgrounds, this music speaks a universality of thought, of human brotherhood, freedom, and love. This weekend, we all raise a glass to those who were there a quarter century ago, the ones who tore down that wall. Wir sind alle Berliner, halten Sie einen Stein der Freiheit. We are all Berliners holding a brick of freedom. World According to Maria Bamford.
Anyways, if you ever start thinking, oh, but I'm a waste of space and I'm a burden, remember that also describes the Grand Canyon. Oh, but I owe people a lot of money and everybody hates me. Hello, Europe. Oh, but I've done some other horrible, unspeakable, unforgivable thing. Google it! Somebody has done exactly what you have done, or worse, has gotten past it and is currently on a book tour. You're never alone!
Comedian Maria Bamford goes where no humorist has gone before. Her troubled self is perfect material up against Louis C.K. on Louis, or up against Tobias in Arrested Development. And of course, there's always the character of Maria's cool, calm, collected family therapist mom, Marilyn, to fall back on.
Honey, we're in Turkey, and the building next to us is on fire, and the imam says we have to switch hotels, which is just crazy. So we're fine, and we're going to go shopping, and I'm just going to wrap myself in a Turkish flag and hope for the best. Your father's taking a video of the fire. Joel! Don't YouTube that, Joel. Don't. I think that's a State Department warning. Oh, jeez. Well, we'll talk to you.
The Takeaway's Kristen Meinzer talked with Bamford about how those bright eyes of hers contain a wealth of story, character, the pain of mental illness, and laughs, most of them at her own expense.
My family is very expressive, hyper liberal, will say, you know, we've always talked about everything, at least within the family, and if not, you know, on a public level. So the great thing about comedy is that if you talk about something that you're horrified about and you hear any laughter, that means somebody else has had the exact same experience. Whereas, like, sometimes if you go and tell a therapist something, you're working with one crowd member, and they might just be horrified. And then you got to find somebody else.
You're talking about some stuff in your stand-up act that some of it is kind of horrifying. I mean, I'm not saying you're horrifying. Some of the ideas are very intense and hard. Like the fear of killing or hurting people you love.
Yes. And as a kid, I think I was around 10 or 11 when I stopped. I wasn't able to sleep very much at night because I was afraid. There's a type of OCD that not everybody has heard of. Mostly you've heard of the kind where you wash your hands or you have to have things in a certain order. And there's another type that sometimes people have heard about with postpartum depression, where it's like a fear of hurting your child, hurting your baby. I've always had, when I was a kid, started fearing that I was going to hurt physically, sexually, hurt my family, friends, strangers, anyone. And what I would do is to try to get myself to not do that. I would grip my fists. I would do sort of a number of rituals, staying up all night. And I couldn't tell it to anybody until I was about 35. Finally, I Googled it. Thank God for the internet. You know, unwanted thoughts or disturbing thoughts. And within, I think, 2 months, I had done these cognitive behavioral exercises. And I was free from something that had plagued me since childhood. It was just unbelievable, unbelievable. And so I felt like it was, you know, I mean, well, the great thing about comedy, too, is that part of shock value, or that, you know, when you somebody breathes in, is a part of making somebody laugh as you build up some sort of tension. So in talking about something, chopping up my family in chunks and bits, and having sex with the chunks and bits, and putting the chunks and bits on a Cobb salad and tossing it and feeding it to my friends, like, that is, and I'm not doing the joke, I'm not doing the joke justice. It is beautifully written, and I wish I still knew it. But that's the great thing, is that I don't have to, the power has been taken away from that fear. And that's what I wanted, I think, to share with other people, was so that somebody else wouldn't have to suffer from it anymore, because I wasn't suffering. And I think the same thing has to do with, you know, I've had bipolar, or whatever they're going to call it. They're probably going to call it banana sandwiches next year. But that I've been hospitalized in a psychiatric facility. And I wanted to talk about that because I felt so ashamed of it. Like, my joke is like, you know, I'm going to kill myself, but I'm not insane. You know, I'm not going to go in somewhere. And I guess after going through that, going, oh, I would like to share that with other people so that maybe somebody else would be, you know, might not take their own lives, or might be more willing to go in to get psychiatric help instead of, and not just psychiatric help, be hospitalized for it. Because I think that was my limitation. I was like, well, I'm not going to go in somewhere. You know, like, and it was hilarious because my mom is a therapist, and she had had a manic episode, and she felt this, you know, no, I'm not going to go in, even though she was a danger to herself and to others, you know. And of course, at that point, your brain is a little bit broken, so you're not doing so well. So that's, I wanted to share about that. But I think I could only share about it in retrospect when I was feeling a little bit better.
And now you sound like you're very much on a path that's where you're really being taken care of in all the ways you need to take care of yourself. Do you feel that this has opened up a whole different world of observation and material for you now that you're feeling happier and healthier?
Well, I hope so. I don't know. I'm sort of inside of it, so I don't know. I know I am much happier than I've ever been. One thing, I didn't want to go on a mood stabilizer before for the same prejudice of like, oh, that means you're crazy. And also there's side effects that didn't seem attractive. The ones that I've gotten from this, I'm on Depakote, is weight gain and a light tremor. And so I always seem a little nervous. But the benefits of the medication, and I think it primarily has been a medication thing, because I have never felt this good in my whole life for this long a time. For 3 years, I have felt, you know, no suicidal ideation even, or any depression, or, you know, just sort of, I think what people, you know, deem to be sort of a normal life where you just feel pretty much okay. Also, I'm a little bit sleepier. But for the lack of wanting to kill myself, I'm in. It's good to be on this stuff.
Comedian Maria Bamford talking with Takeaway producer Kristen Meinzer. Maria is currently featured in the USA sitcom Benched. Today, the lovely literary Strand magazine publishes a forgotten and virtually unknown story of John Steinbeck called With Your Wings, the story of a black man learning to fly and lifting his family and every other black man in America up into the sky with him. It was read by Orson Welles on his radio variety show back in July of 1944, a quirky show that itself is nearly forgotten.
Good evening, this is Orson Welles, just saying hello before the show starts. This is your radio almanac for March 8th. The moon entered Virgo this morning. The moon in Virgo is a nice, sociable sign, friendly and helpful, like the man who sells you your mobile gas.
Welles loved to read stories and speak with guests. Commercials were also a part of the show in a much more relaxed way than they are today in the media. Andrew Gooley, managing editor of the Strand magazine, found the story With Your Wings while combing through the University of Texas library. Here's the first line of the story. He knew most of all that he wanted to go home, that there was something at home he had to get, and he didn't even know what that was.
John Steinbeck was a very progressive writer. He was ahead of his time, and he was a writer who had always tried to speak out for people who were marginalized, people who were poor, people who were suffering. And the story is about this young African-American soldier who's coming back to his hometown after training to be an Air Force pilot. And this was a time where African-American soldiers were not treated very well. They were not allowed to worship in the same chapels where white soldiers had worshipped. They were separated in their eating quarters. So Steinbeck was, I think, trying to give a very, very powerful message how most African Americans had looked at World War II as part of their fight and part of something that they needed to contribute to the United States. And this might have been a faint cry saying that perhaps the U.S. Army and a lot of states should have passed laws to treat these people better.
So I read this twice, Andrew. The first time I read it through, it was this very emotional, wow, what a moment for an African American to come home and to be recognized by his family as having achieved this milestone, the gold bars on his shoulders. And then I read it a second time, and I thought to myself, all right, from the African-American's perspective, this could be seen as a very over-sentimentalized view of what was going on at the time. How do you see that?
I have a bit of a mixed feeling on both things. I would say I had a similar feeling to that. And a part of me did agree that at the end, perhaps it was over-sentimentalized. Perhaps it was making something appear cleaner, making something appear more harmonious than it was. But then I stepped back a little and I said to myself, let's take things in their context. And the United States in 1944, I don't know if the radio listeners were ready to hear something that was quite hard-hitting about how African-Americans were segregated in the army. And I think that this was John Steinbeck's way of trying to show something in a sentimentalized way with a hope that that would bring some understanding among people who were perhaps bigoted, people who are not as progressive as he was.
You know, I'm looking at this great line, which is the big reveal, although there is a reference to the kinky hair of his brother that happens a couple of paragraphs before, which is kind of a clue, a signpost of what you're about to learn. But the father says to the son, "Son, every black man in the world is going to fly with your wings." I wonder, you know, there could be a lot of lines there. You know, it could be, "Watch your back, son."
You know, that's a great point. The reason I think Steinbeck has resonated with people for the past 70 years is that he's able to have everybody, all his readers, walk inside the shoes of another person, be it an impoverished farmer in the Dust Bowl or a young African-American soldier who's trying to come to the terms with the fact that he's feeling a huge weight of expectations on his shoulders and a lot of pressure. So when I read that, I just stepped back and I said to myself, my God, this is giving me a perspective on how a minority and an African-American had felt fighting during World War II that I had never, ever had. I'd never paused to think, my God, there can be a lot of mixed feelings about not being treated well, which I had hoped perhaps that maybe there is a bit of more of a clue to that, but also a feeling of great pressure, feeling that you're an outlier, you're one of the first people who is marching head on into something that's unknown.
Well, there's definitely a feeling of pressure, but it's very much a sense of pure pride, almost as though there will be time later for the worries about how you'll be treated in the air, or how you'll have to be an example, and you'll have to be perfect, and that if you aren't the best pilot in the world, that everyone's going to be bringing you down. The sense of having to be sort of the Jackie Robinson, you know, which comes in the next decade. This story really gives us that.
Exactly, and to even go forward on something. John Steinbeck of the 1940s was a different John Steinbeck from the 1950s and 60s, in that he came to see the United States as a country where excess was killing us, where a lot of he'd hoped that the civil rights movement would progress quicker than it had progressed. And he was frustrated at how in the South Black children were being harassed when they were going to school. And he said at one point, to paraphrase him, he said that he was not a violent man, but if people were treating his children and harassing them in such a fashion, he said, I might, you know, take a stick and start hitting people on the head with that. And another interesting part of John Steinbeck is, though he was very progressive, he was a supporter of the Vietnam War in the 60s. The reason he had supported the war was because he was supportive of the Great Society policies of Lyndon Johnson, and he even helped him write the platform for the Great Society. He was just looking at Johnson as this transformative figure who would change a lot of the domestic policies of the United States to be more progressive.
Well, with the exception of the war in Iraq, it's you know, very profound to see that Steinbeck spans this whole period of American history and so much change. And in this little simple story, we can see so much of 20th century U.S. history. Now, you need to get yourself along back into the library to find another one of these gems so that we can talk again.
Well, you have about two more that I can promise you will be coming out next year.
Well, that's fabulous to hear. Andrew Gulley, managing editor of The Strand Magazine, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan. Always fun chatting with you.
That's our show for the day and the week. Are you a part of that 5.8% unemployment energy that's driving our economy? Check us out at thetakeaway.org and take us with you this weekend. Check out our daily podcast. Go to the iTunes store and type in The Takeaway. You can take The Weekender with you all weekend long. We'll talk about our process of creating fake political ads, give you a preview of a terrific conversation coming up about Jackie Kennedy and her struggles with PTSD. That's right, PTSD. We'll also have an extended interview with comedian Maria Bamford. Next week, I'll be broadcasting from KUOW in the great green Emerald Empire of Seattle. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.